Today in Studio 360,
Spider-Man!
We watch as the most expensive show in Broadway history, Spider-Man, goes splat.
As soon as the show started, people took out their cell phone cameras because they were all hoping that they would capture somebody getting clocked.
The director, Julie Taymor, was kicked off the production, but the show must go on.
The only way they're going to sell any tickets at a 10,000-seat arena is if Bono plays Spider-Man himself.
Speaking of Bono, we'll go guitar shopping with Daniel Lanois, who has produced U2 and a bunch of the classic records of our time. And I'll talk to Jennifer Egan, whose freshly prize-winning novel gets down and dirty in the entertainment industry with aging rock stars, deranged journalists, and skeevy executives. I'm Kurt Anderson. That is all ahead today in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, presenting the redesigned Scion TC, featuring a 180-horsepower engine and responsive handling, giving you the power to maneuver today's congested cities. Get there at Scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson.
Okay, welcome back. I want to get back to this breaking news out of Japan. This is where we believe the impact took place.
Last weekend, reporters scrambled to cover the unfolding horror of Japan's earthquake and tsunami. A CNN correspondent said something that caught our attention.
Waves of debris. It's almost like a monster movie, just seeing this stuff wiping out entire sections of the coastline.
Bill Tsutsui happened to be visiting Tokyo.
We were outside this hotel and the earth started moving and all of a sudden people started running out. First just a few, but then wave after wave. And after it was over, one of my colleagues turned to me and said, you know, that reminded me of a Godzilla movie.
Professor Tsutsui, who's Japanese-American, wrote a book a few years ago called Godzilla on My Mind.
After having watched Godzilla movies for really my entire life, all of a sudden I felt in a way like I was inside one. And it felt very uncomfortable.
And he says that Japanese monster movies, like Godzilla, came directly out of the country's experience in World War II.
You know, the original Godzilla film was a very dark reflection on the horrors of nuclear war and the threat of nuclear holocaust in the future. It was not a kiddie film, as later films in the series became. It was very much geared towards adults, and it very much had a message. We have to pull back from the nuclear brink now, or we risk destroying our entire world.
And this is a theme that seems to keep coming up from Godzilla to Akira, the big breakthrough anime movie in 1988 about life after nuclear apocalypse.
You know, I think that that theme is always there. And if you look at the history of Japanese pop culture since World War II, one of the abiding characteristics is this imagination of disaster. That, in fact, is what Susan Sontag called it back in 1965. And it's continued up to the present. She described the modern world as being this unusual combination of unremitting banality and inconceivable terror. And the role of popular culture was to distract you, but also to prepare you for the inevitable apocalypse to come. And so the Japanese have very, very much participated in this.
Well, and you have this pop culture of the last half century depicting those kinds of things, depicting apocalypse and recovery and all that. But then the most famous piece of Japanese visual art from a long time ago is, of course, the giant tsunami wave, right?
Sure.
Hiroshige.
I mean, I think this has been a part of Japanese aesthetics for a very, very long time. Many know of the concept of mono no aware, which means sort of the pathos of things. It really captures that Japanese appreciation for the beauty of transience, the beauty of a passing season, a falling leaf, a dying flower. And that very much underlies the kind of pop culture sensibilities we see since World War II as well.
Well, even in the original Godzilla movie, Gojira, from in 1954, not long after the war, not long after the atomic bombs, there was this sense of, okay, there's an aftermath, and we will go on. We will rebuild.
You know, it's interesting. As many times as Tokyo gets destroyed in Japanese anime and on Japanese films, it also gets reborn. It gets rebuilt. And I think one of the great examples of that is the television series Ultraman. It started in the 1960s. It was made by the special effects genius Tsuburaya Eiji, who worked on the Godzilla films. And in that series, on a weekly basis, an alien descends upon Tokyo. The city is destroyed. You see it in flames. And yet, miraculously, the next week it is born again. There's this kind of self-healing quality to the city. And I think that really expressed the optimism which many Japanese people felt about the ability of their nation to bounce back.
And Japanese artists are already imagining classic anime characters dealing with the current crisis.
That's right. Yeah, there are a couple of manga artists who have been posting via Twitter. Twitter is quite popular in Japan. Posting images of sort of classic anime and television superheroes.
That's Roland Keltz. He's also Japanese-American, writes about Japanese pop culture, and teaches in Tokyo.
Such as Ultraman or Kamen Rider, who is a bicycle-riding insect hero, insect-looking hero. And these characters from the Japanese popular cultural imagination are shown in these manga images, panels, out in the streets helping the refugees from the earthquake and helping the local services, local social service centers, put people into wheelchairs and get them into safety. So there's this idea that the Japan's superheroes, if you will, or Japan's icons of manga, anime, and television as well, are jumping into the act and to the rescue.
How interesting! I mean, it's one more piece of evidence of how deeply embedded in the national imagination, the popular imagination, these. Anime, manga, superheroes are.
I think it also speaks to the animistic nature of Shinto. And so, you know, there are so many depictions of, for example, throughout centuries, the catfish swishing its tail back and forth. And one of the myths in Japanese culture is that this massive catfish swishing its tail causes earthquakes to occur. And it makes perfect sense, I think, now that the popular imagination is looking to these anime characters, animated figures, to come out of the woodwork and help.
Well, and I remember not long before the last Miyazaki film, Ponyo, where there was this incredible tsunami that happens, this anthropomorphized tsunami with a sort of evil face coming at the characters.
Yeah, actually, it's it has eyes. The waves have these eyes that are quite hard to read. They're not necessarily menacing, although the storm itself is quite menacing. But this extraordinary image of these humps in the sea kind of rising up and down with these eyes on, and as the tsunami approaches the coast of Japan, and of course the main character and his mother are in an automobile racing to get away from the tsunami, which is an image that sadly showed up in real life on television just last Friday.
The fish are following us now!
Turn around, sit down!
I've never seen the ocean like this.
What Japan is living through now combines its primordial fears of earthquake and tsunami with the more recent experience of nuclear devastation.
The Japanese narrative tends to begin with the end of the world, as in classically in Akira, and then the story itself begins after the city is rebuilt or after the country is rebuilt. And the story is actually then itself a post-apocalyptic story, just as Japan after 1945 is arguably the first post-apocalyptic society.
Though I think one important aspect to keep in mind is that most young Japanese have no memory of World War II. They have no memory of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And these are things that have not been talked about in general in history classes or in polite society. So much of their knowledge of these traumas in the past have come through popular culture, through anime like Grave of the Fireflies, rather than through formal education.
Grave of the Fireflies is the anime movie about two young orphans in Japan who have to fend for themselves at the end of World War II. And what a beautiful and terribly sad movie that is. I'm not sure I'd ever seen my daughter cry so much as when we watched it.
I mean, I think it captures very well how even in the moments of greatest trauma, there can be moments of beauty. And I heard a story from one person from this current earthquake. He was living up in the hills to the north of Tokyo, and he lived in a cabin out in the woods. And when the earth started to shake, he went outside, and his house was surrounded by cedar trees. And the earthquake shook loose all of the pollen from the cedar trees, which was bright yellow. And so he described it as being like golden clouds floating over the hillsides. And so despite all the destruction taking place on the northeast coast of Japan, in his little corner of the Japanese universe, it was serenely beautiful.
Bill Tsutsui is the author of Godzilla on My Mind and a dean at Southern Methodist University. We also heard from Roland Keltz, the author of Japan America. Still to come this hour, I'll talk with the actress Catherine Deneuve, and we'll visit with the legendary music producer Daniel Lanois. That and more is ahead today in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, presenting the redesigned Scion TC, featuring a 180-horsepower engine and responsive handling, giving you the power to maneuver today's congested cities. Get there at Scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. The new musical, Spider-Man: Turn Off the Dark, is the most expensive show in Broadway history by far. It's a gigantic spectacle with music by U2, directed by Julie Taymor, with actors flying over the audience and fighting in midair. And this week was the big opening. No, wait, that didn't happen.
Now, I know you've had a really difficult time with this show, bad reviews, injuries.
Seth, no one said this was going to be easy. It's like I say to my actors, look out, get out of there!
That's Kristen Wiig of Saturday Night Live as Julie Taymor, Spider-Man's director and creator who has now been purged. How could a triple brand name $70 million investment go so very, very wrong? We asked Studio 360's Eric Molinsky to try to find out.
With great power comes great responsibility.
With great power comes great responsibility. It's Spider-Man's lament, and Julie Taymor's. If you believe media reports, she's used her power irresponsibly. She burned through millions of dollars during a recession, and she toyed with the safety of her actors.
To which I would respond, well, if you're going to go with a Spider-Man-based narrative, how many issues of Spider-Man end with Spider-Man sitting there alone on a rooftop bemoaning how every single thing seems to go wrong for him?
Peter David is a comic book writer, and he's written issues of Spider-Man. Now, David wasn't involved in the show, but he wrote a mostly positive review in his blog, much to the surprise of his colleagues.
People have been gunning for this show for months. And I don't know if it's because it's a woman directing it. I don't know if it's simply because of the amount of money involved.
It's all about the money, according to Jeremy Gerard. He's a theater critic for Bloomberg News.
When Julie Taymor was quoted in New York Magazine as saying that it's nobody's business if a bunch of millionaires want to invest $65 million or more in a show, I took offense at that. It is certainly our business as critics, because those of us who have followed Julie Taymor's career know that she's a prime example of how limitations make art, not the absence of limitations, and that this feels like something that got way out of control.
After 8 years, the show finally began previews in November. It was supposed to open in January. There were technical glitches, the plot was confusing, actors injured, fines for safety violations. I'm sure you remember the headlines. Normally, critics wait until opening night to write reviews, but Jeremy Gerard was the first to break that tradition, and the others followed.
It was an extraordinary circumstance, and I didn't feel that I was going to allow the producers to determine when I could engage in the conversation about this show.
Because everybody else was talking about it. Spider-Man the Musical is coming out at a time when anyone can post reviews on their blogs, Facebook pages, and Twitter feeds. And those DIY reviewers compete with official critics, like Michael Riedel of the New York Post.
When I went to see Spider-Man, as soon as the show started, people took out their cell phone cameras because they were all hoping that they would capture on their cell phone cameras somebody getting clocked.
His coverage of the show has been scathing, especially the circus-like acrobatics.
You have to remember, on Spider-Man, the special effects were so state-of-the-art, as Julie Taymor kept telling everybody, that they have spent so much time just worrying about the special effects and not paying too much attention to the story, which is a disaster, and the score, which is very boring.
Movie directors didn't try to take on Spider-Man until they could fake the stunts with computer animation. And that's what audiences are used to now. Acrobatics good enough for a video game. Douglas Rushkoff, a media critic, thinks that Julie Taymor was just trying to keep up with the public's imagination, and that was a mistake.
I suppose that there is a camp who believes that for Broadway to remain relevant, it's got to somehow get into that arms race. I do not think that that's a race that Broadway can be in. Ideally, Broadway's analog. You know, it's not digital.
But he doesn't blame Taymor, at least not entirely.
I almost never blame the artist. It's her job to imagine stuff. And it's her technical advisors who are there to tell her what's possible and what's not.
Peter David, the comic book writer, also thinks there was a double standard.
Did you know that Idina Menzel fell wrong through a trapdoor in Wicked and broke a rib? Did you know that in Fela, three of the main dancers went down with injuries sustained in the show, and they had to shut down and skip some performances and go dark because they literally had lost too many dancers and they couldn't go on? If that had happened in Spider-Man, it would have been front page in the Daily News.
So what happens if the critics get their wish? A little bit of schadenfreude. What if Spider-Man, Turn Off the Dark, finally opens again to bad reviews and goes dark? It doesn't matter. The plan is to take the show on the road to giant arenas. Michael Riedel is skeptical.
From what I've seen, the only way they're going to sell any tickets at a 10,000-seat arena is if Bono plays Spider-Man himself.
Jeremy Gerard thinks the price tag will carry a stigma.
The phrase $65 million Broadway show and most expensive show ever produced on Broadway will be forever attached to this show.
Forever. That is, until the next Julie Taymor comes along and plots an even more ambitious musical. Star Wars, Batman, Avatar. So many options. For Studio 360, I'm Eric Molinsky.
You can fly to
When I saw Spider-Man in January, during the first act, I actually found myself pleasantly surprised. This isn't so terrible, I thought. It's cool looking and fun. But then came the second act, when, for me, everything went completely and totally off the rails in ways big and small. Small, like, for instance, why is the newspaper in the show all 1940s-ish, but the rest of the characters are totally in the 21st century? I could go on. But let's hear what you think. Almost 200,000 people have seen Spider-Man in previews. If you're one of them, we'd like to hear your advice to the creative team about how to overhaul the show. tell us at studio360.org, and we'll collect some of your advice for next week's show. While Spider-Man seems to be trapped in a web of its own making, the good news just keeps coming for the writer Jennifer Egan. Her latest, A Visit from the Goon Squad, just won the National Book Critics Circle Award as the best novel of the year. It follows a group of characters jumping forward, backward, and sideways in history. It is funny and touching, and the structure of the book is unorthodox. It doesn't have a traditional beginning, middle, or end, and one chapter is written entirely as a PowerPoint presentation. I talked to Jennifer Egan just after the book came out, and she told me that it started as some short story exercises, really just practice rounds for an entirely different novel.
I really thought I was just writing some stories to kind of get loose in order to get ready to begin this book that I wanted to begin. But fairly quickly, I felt really driven to keep moving, not in a linear direction, but in a sort of sidelong direction. Like a minor character would catch my eye and I would think, oh, I want to plunge right into the middle of their lives. So then I would write another piece. But at a certain point, I just thought, you know, I can't worry about this. I have to just have fun and keep rolling with it. And that's pretty much what I did. I tried not to worry too much about genre because I knew that genre wasn't really going to work for me on this one.
If somebody asked you to describe the genre, what would you say?
Well, they get a very long explanation and they start to glaze over.
Because it's science fiction, it's 80s nostalgia. It's a lot of things.
Yeah, there's a lot of rock and roll in there. It's very much about time. It's a lot about youth and kind of what music means to young people, but it's, of course, very much about getting older, too. You know, I just felt like the point was to try to have fun and do something that felt fresh.
This takes place over 40 years or more. As you say, it's a lot about the passage of time. And I was struck by your characters, some of whom we see go from young to middle-aged, at their kind of shock at being old in a certain way. And I had the same reaction when I was reading Jonathan Franzen's new novel as well. Is that something that people, middle-aged writers today, are obsessed with? Their generational surprise at suddenly finding themselves old?
We have no preparation for getting old. We're always young, and then suddenly we're not. So I think there's some psychological way in which we identify old as other. And then there's that shocking moment when we realize that we have crossed over. We are perceived as the other by all those young people who, you know, can't imagine they will ever reach our age. So I personally, I don't actually feel that obsessed with getting old. Yeah. I think, again, it was a mood and a moment that I embraced for this book, but I can already feel myself moving away from it. And it really was that I wanted to take a crack at time as a subject.
There's a chapter, more than one chapter, about Benny, who's a music industry executive and earlier a punk rocker. One of those chapters, he's listing all his most shameful memories in a kind of compulsive way. I wonder if you could read from that.
Absolutely. The shame memories began early that day for Benny during the morning meeting. While he listened to one of his senior executives make a case for pulling the plug on Stop Go, a sister band Benny had signed to a 3-record deal a couple of years back. Then Stop Go had seemed like an excellent bet. The sisters were young and adorable. Their sound was gritty and simple and catchy. Cyndi Lauper meets Chrissy Hynde had been Benny's line early on. With a big gulping bass and some fun percussion, he recalled a cowbell. Plus, they'd written decent songs. Hell, they'd sold 12,000 CDs off the stage before Benny ever heard them play. A little time to develop potential singles, some clever marketing, and a decent video could put them over the top. But the sisters were pushing 30, his executive producer, Colette, informed Benny now, and no longer credible as recent high school grads, especially since one of them had a 9-year-old daughter. Their band members were in law school. They'd fired 2 producers and a 3rd had quit. Still, no album. Who's managing them? Benny asked. Their father. I've got their new rough mix, Colette said. The vocals are buried under 7 layers of guitar. It was then that the memory overcame Benny. Had the word sisters brought it on? himself squatting behind a nunnery in Westchester at sunrise after a night of partying. 20 years ago, was it? More? Hearing waves of pure, ringing, spooky, sweet sound waft into the paling sky. Cloistered nuns who saw no one but one another, who'd taken vows of silence, singing the Mass. Wet grass under his knees, its iridescence pulsing against his exhausted eyeballs. Even now, Benny could hear the unearthly sweetness of those nuns' voices echoing deep in his ears.
That's Jennifer Egan reading from A Visit from the Goon Squad. Benny is a music executive. Nearly all the characters are in or around the music business in some way, or else huge fans. Were you like that?
Not really. No. I mean, that's an example of a way in which I embraced a world because I wanted to write about it, but it's not that I had any particular relationship to it personally. I mean, I was a kid who went to clubs and heard concerts, but that's true of, you know, a lot of American teenagers.
Yes.
I probably haven't been to a concert in 15 years.
Was there a moment when pop music suddenly you said, it doesn't matter to me as much as it did?
There wasn't a moment. It's a good question. You know, one of the things I was interested in this book is the way in which there's a tension between the way time passes and the way we seem to be able to perceive it. And the effect of that is often that one discovers that something has happened without knowing when it happened. And I guess I would have to say that that's how it is with me and feeling a really deeply vital relationship to pop music.
On your website, you talk about the soundtracks of your writing. What did you listen to while you were writing this book?
It really depended on what chapter I was working on. I think the most fun I had musically was remembering that the really obscure, punk bands of the late 70s in San Francisco. Then there's a chapter called Out of Body that takes place in the early 90s, and that was another very particular musical moment. I was really into a band called Curve. Thinking back on what you listened to is so much also about remembering how you listened to it. You know, that was part of the experience. Now we buy music in this very atomized way.
I think, you know, seeing my young adult children, they don't get as into music as one did 20, 30, 40 years ago.
You know, I don't know about that. I mean, I have a 9-year-old who lives and breathes Eminem, and we talk about Eminem all the time. We dissect his lyrics. It took me a little while to embrace Eminem, but it has happened.
Is this a boy, 9-year-old?
A 9-year-old boy. He's been writing rap songs of his own. I mean, he feels it.
And he lives in Brooklyn.
Exactly. So, you know, I don't know. I mean, maybe it happens younger. Maybe it happens in a different way. But he's read several biographies of Eminem. He's deeply, deeply into this guy in a way that I really recognize, although it certainly hadn't happened to me at 9 years old.
This chapter that you write in PowerPoint, which is a 12-year-old girl, a child of one of the earlier characters, is writing in this future moment. Talk about something that could have gone badly wrong. When I came to that first page of that chapter, and I go, really? She's really going to do this? I thought I despaired. But you pull it off absolutely wonderfully, and it's sort of moving and charming and very convincingly childlike. Was that a sort of eureka moment when you decide, oh, I'll do this? This is how a kid will write fiction in the future? Or
There was a eureka moment. It wasn't exactly like that. I write by hand. I write fiction by hand. So I thought I'll write PowerPoint by hand. But of course, that was a total loser. Yeah, it was. It was funny for about a minute, and then it was really painful. And what kept happening was that it would just devolve into regular prose. But the other big problem was that the question with using PowerPoint was, why is someone writing in PowerPoint? And it's a very corporate genre, of course, in our world. The eureka moment was realizing that if a 12-year-old did it, it wouldn't feel corporate.
You are very open about, here's where I got this material, here's how I used this, which is refreshing given that certain kind of serious novelists, and many serious novelists seem to feel as though the more mysterious, the better. The more I stay behind the curtain, don't reveal my tricks, the better. Why do you do otherwise?
In the case of this particular book, it seemed to make sense to do that.
It's not a deep part of some new desire on your part to reveal yourself to your readers.
Well, we'll see. I mean, if the endless memoir is what I end up writing next instead of my historical novel, we'll know that a monster was unleashed. But generally, I'm fairly bored by my own life and eager to escape from it. I think that's one reason I write so often about men and from the male point of view.
You say you like writing male characters. There are some fairly skeevy male characters in this book. Is that fun?
It is. It's funny. I'm very fond of all of them. So when you say skeevy, I'm not even quite sure which ones you mean, because I don't really think of them that way, in the way that I guess you don't think of a family member that way. I mean, I live a pretty ordinary life, but, you know, I like to write about people who don't.
Jennifer Egan, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Jennifer Egan's new book is called A Visit from the Goon Squad, and it just won the National Book Critics Circle Award as the best novel of the year. Goon Squad. They've come to look you over and they're giving you the eye. Goon Squad. The ones who to come out to play, they better say goodbye. The music business has very famous people out front, the rock stars, but then behind the scenes are the people who pull it all together, the producers. In that realm, Daniel Lanois is a legend. He has worked with Emmylou Harris, Brian Eno, U2, and more. And he recently published his autobiography, so we sent one of our own producers, Pike Malinowski, to talk with him.
You probably know this song.
One love, one life.
And you probably know this one too.
All you do is call me. I'll be anything you need.
And how about this one?
Meet me at the wrecking ball. Wrecking ball. I'll wear something pretty.
And maybe you know this one too.
Not a word, a goodbye. Not even a note. She gone with a man in a long black coat.
But what you might not know is that they were all produced by the same guy, Daniel Lanois. I met him recently to talk to him about his new autobiography, Soul Mining.
He's going to need, I guess, a little bit of privacy when they do this interview.
And right from the beginning, I got a sense of why everybody wants to work with him. He's a nice guy. The first thing he does is offer to hold my microphone.
Do you want me to hold this? Or
I can hold it.
Okay.
And as we're walking through Greenwich Village in New York City, he talks about the humbleness he feels for the great artists who came before him.
I always like walking these streets late at night, and, you know, to walk the streets that people before us have walked, and other creative folks with dreams, and poets, and musicians. So I think it's good to be humble in that situation, you know, to know that, you know, Charlie Parker might have played saxophone on the next street and Miles Davis was here. And, I mean, we all do what we do because we love someone else's work, you know, so it's, I'm no exception that I came into my own work by being a fan of other artists, obviously. And
right.
So New York City held a lot for me that way.
A trademark of Daniel Lanois' producer skills is his use of rooms, or depth of field.
Well, depth of field is a photographic term for, you know, something's close and something's far away.
He's the master of creating laid-back musical landscapes that feel like the sound is coming from miles away. He says we're biologically wired for that.
If we could go back to primal times, if something's far away, then it's not about to eat you. You know, when we cross the street, if we hear a noise right near us, then we're obviously going to pay attention. But if it's a siren from across the city, then, you know, the danger is not nearby. So I've enjoyed experimenting with different kind of rooms over the years, and if we could use rooms as a figure of speech for anticipating what the unknown might bring.
When they were still just kids, Daniel and his brother built their own recording studio in their mother's basement. That was Ancaster, Canada, 1960s.
Well, my dad was a carpenter, and he'd take us onto some of the jobs. You know, we'd help him with some roofings, and there are a lot of lessons to be learned from something like that. You know, if you're in an environment of building, I think it's really a great establishment for dreams later on.
They quickly developed a unique sound, and musicians came from far away to record in the basement while Mother was cooking for them upstairs. So, I had planned to take Daniel to a guitar store for a talk about his favorite topic, tools.
How are you?
Turned out he had actually been there a couple of weeks earlier to have a guitar strung.
Nice to see you. Thanks for fixing up my 12-string. It really saved my life because that E string was really wonky out of tune, but when you had to go at it, it solved all the problems.
In his new autobiography, Soul Mining, he talks about the importance of tools in finding one's voice. At one point he says, it's about believing that a song lives inside a guitar by just looking at it up on a wall. Are you serious?
I'm completely serious. You go through a guitar store and have a look at instruments, and then there's one that will have a vibe on it that you resonate with, and then just maybe give it a little strum, and if it sounds good, then maybe that's the one to take home.
We grab a couple of stools in the back of the guitar store, which doubles as a workshop, full of old wood and half-finished guitars. Daniel spots a vintage Martin over in the corner and starts to geek out.
That's a nice Martin over there, the spruce top, Brazilian rosewood. So that tells a story right there, because that particular kind of Brazilian rosewood became illegal about 1964, so it tells you it has a fixed point in time. It has Grover tuning pegs, which means at that point Martin had stepped into higher grade tuning pegs. And so just by looking at it, you see history, you see a turning point in mechanics with the machine heads. You see the final chapter of the Brazilian rosewood, and you see that the spruce top has a lot of years on it, so it probably has a beautiful resonant sound to it.
So could that inspire you to write a song just looking at that guitar? Or?
It might inspire me to write about the disappearance of a certain kind of specimen, and maybe if not specifically about the Brazilian rosewood, then you might want to write about the disappearing values as we enter a new chapter of life. You know, that the old values fall by the wayside and new ones are embraced, whether they be your own or the values of a neighborhood and so on. I mean, there's no two guitars are the same, and so we always look for personality in an instrument. You know, that personality leads to songwriting.
Would you want to play a song? Pick up a guitar.
I could play a song. So I'm a finger picker, really, which is something I learned when I was a kid. So I still use the technique.
Talk about having anger in your book, but I don't really feel that.
I talk about Billy Bob Thornton saying that he thought that I had anger in me, so we'd have to ask Billy what he meant exactly.
Do you?
I don't know if I have anger in me. It's just, you know, I think everybody has frustration in them from somewhere along the way, and I mean, we don't like that to come out in everyday situations, but I think in our work sometimes if something's been bottled up, you know, it'll come out in songs or paintings, whatever happens to be your line of work artistically.
Nice. As we're leaving the guitar store, Daniel pulls out a fistful of $20 bills and hands it to Rick, the owner, pretending he just found it on the floor.
Drop this in the back.
Oh, thanks, man. You sure? It
does yeah, yeah. Okay. Thank from, you, from Danny's pocket.
No, nice right, guy.
You deserve more than that, my friend.
Thank you.
I'll be back.
All right, great.
When will we design our new line of instruments?
All right, good.
We'll make it all back.
Thanks. See you.
For Studio 360, I'm Pike Menidowski.
The crafty Daniel Lanois' autobiography is called Soul Mining, and it's out right now. His latest gig as a songwriter and performer is with a group called Black Dub. Coming up, I've got a date with Catherine Deneuve.
He understands I cannot talk about feelings. He lets me show him in other ways.
Yikes! That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Toi jamais. Mettre à mes pieds leur fortune et me décrocher la lune. Toi jamais. Et chaque fois qu'il m'appelle. Ils me disent que je suis belle, toi jamais.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, presenting the redesigned Scion TC, featuring a 180-horsepower engine and responsive handling, giving you the power to maneuver today's congested cities. Get there at Scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson.
Regarde-moi, mon garçon. Quand tu reviendras, je ne sais pas si je serai encore de ce monde.
She became a star in movies like Umbrellas of Cherbourg, Belle du Jour, and Roman Polanski's Repulsion. And almost half a century later, Catherine Deneuve is probably still the most famous French actor in America. Yes, because she can act, and yes, because she was beautiful then and beautiful now, but also because she epitomizes a kind of continental classiness. She's 67 now and starring in a new comedy called Potiche. She came to Los Angeles this month, and I caught up with her at the French consulate in Beverly Hills. She was, true to national stereotype, smoking. Indoors. We were in the pool house out behind the consulate, and the first thing we had to do was turn off the noisy air conditioner.
Okay, before you get hot, we'll start.
Let's start before it gets hot.
I asked her about her first breakthrough film, Umbrellas of Cherbourg, from 1964, which she made when she was just 19 years old.
The film was very special. It's like an opera. It's completely musical.
And then, so suddenly, you're Catherine Deneuve, Umbrellas of Cherbourg. did your life transform instantly?
No, it doesn't work that way, no. Not
really?
Instantly.
I want it to work that way.
It didn't work really that way, but I was always very lucky because I was proposed films. And that's also when I got proposed to do the Chanel ad.
It's not important that I'm Catherine Deneuve. I know he loves me for what I'm deeply.
Which was, you know, something very important for me in America. People knew me more for the Chanel than for the films, because French films, it's a limited audience.
Chanel number 5, Eau de Cologne. You don't have to ask for it. He knows what you want, Chanel.
Your new film, Potiche, which is a word that means trophy wife.
Yes, but it's not fair to say trophy wife, because a potiche can be a man as well, you know.
Uh-huh.
So it's
and you
it's
have some fun in the film when your husband says, oh, now I'm a potiche.
Yeah, it's true. It's just a potiche is just an object, you know, big and decorative that he's there just to look good and but has not much use.
And your character named Suzanne takes over her husband's umbrella factory in the 1970s. And she's just this normal bourgeois housewife, but then becomes this great factory manager and kind of feminist heroine.
Yeah, she discovers something new in her. That she didn't know that was there, but she didn't know she didn't have the occasion to be that person.
Did that resonate with you, this idea of...
No.
No? Not at all?
Not at all. I had fun doing the film. I love the film, and I like very much the story, but it doesn't really has nothing to do with you. Me, certainly not. No.
Although in the 70s, certainly, as feminism was being born, you were an outspoken feminist and signed petitions.
Yeah, that's why I was not the character. You know?
Yeah, yeah. You were well advanced beyond that character.
Well, I was younger, you know. So I was not the age of the character.
Yes, you were like her daughter. I thought as I was watching the film.
Yeah, I would have been more like the daughter. Yeah.
Maman, tu es là?
Ah, Joël. Bonjour, ma chérie.
Bon anniversaire. Je viens de l'acheter pour toi.
Oh, merci. Comment tu as pensé?
Your parents were actors. You didn't go to movies until relatively late in your childhood. Was there a moment after you first acted where you thought, this is something I really want to do with my
life? I did Umbrella of Sherbrooke when I met Jacques Demy, yes.
Really? Not until then?
Well, I was 20, huh?
Yeah.
That's not much.
And why was that so transformative?
Because the experience was very special, because it was him, because of the relation I had with him and the way he talked about it, the way he looked at me and the way I felt, you know, on the set working with him. It was something I had never experienced before.
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't done that many films, you know, when I met him. I had done, I think, 3-4 films, that's all.
We asked our listeners for questions, and many came in. When the mud was thrown at you in Belle du Jour, what was that like?
It was fun, because when you have to do special things for a film, it's not like you... they didn't throw mud, you know. You have to rehearse, you have to prepare where you are going to send the mud. It's not the actor who is doing it, it's the special effect man. I mean, you know, there is a lot of technical, funny things around it.
Annulé! Pur infime! C'est la timone! Espermatrice! Confiance!
Pierre, je t'en supplie, arrête, je t'aime, Pierre!
I assume it was the first time that had happened to you.
Well, of course, it's quite unusual, huh?
Yeah. Now, the second question is, a listener named Michael Donovan asks, will you marry me?
Marry who?
Michael Donovan wants you to marry him. He's asking for your hand in marriage.
I don't think that's very reasonable.
You've been quoted in the past as saying you don't believe in marriage.
No, I didn't say that. I didn't think I needed, you know, to be married. You know, I don't think marriage is a trouble. I just think it's not necessary for me. And at the time when I had children, it was quite shocking because at the time not many people had children so young without out of marriage. But, you know, my life, you know, my private life, it's something that I don't accept society to tell me what to do. As long as I don't hurt anyone and it's only my own life, I think I have the right to do what I want.
Do you expect you're going to keep acting until you shuffle off, until the
end? I don't know.
Yeah?
I don't know, but for the moment, you know, I'm working because I like the projects I'm doing, and but I suppose if I didn't think the project were interesting enough, I wouldn't go on doing it, no.
Catherine Deneuve, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Catherine Deneuve's new movie, Potiche, opens in America on March 25th. Before she headed off to the airport to fly back to Paris, there was another question I wanted to ask her about Carla Bruni Sarkozy, the wife of the French Prime Minister, acting in a movie that's coming out in May. What do you think of the First Lady appearing in a Woody Allen film?
I don't know. I find it strange, but, you know, it looks very much like the world of today. And
it is a very 21st century fact, yeah.
Yeah, it's unusual. Let's say it's unusual.
How subtly the French can express disapproval. We will close today's show with a few words from you. Last week, we talked once again about John Steinbeck's book, Travels with Charlie, about his visit to Monterey, California, where he had grown up. And when he returned as an older man, he found it depressing. Steinbeck wrote, "What we knew is dead. What's out there is new and perhaps good, but it's nothing we know." I asked if any of you had ever felt the same way.
My name is Doug Hill. I grew up in Wichita, Kansas, and moved to Carmel when I was 14.
Carmel, California, is not far from Monterey.
I was like a lot of teenagers. I couldn't wait to get out of there. But looking back on it, I loved it dearly. My brother and I owned a psychedelic shop in Carmel in 1967, and we had a booth at the Monterey Pop Festival, and it was, you know, exciting time.
But Doug watched his bit of paradise being suburbanized.
Highway expansion, shopping centers, housing developments. I just hated it. I literally did move away because I just couldn't bear to watch the destruction.
And where'd he go?
I remember moving to New York, and this is 1975, with the feeling that, okay, if Western civilization's going down, I might as well go right to the epicenter of the collapse.
Thanks to Doug and everyone else who wrote in. If you have a memory of returning home or fleeing from home, tell us about it at studio360.org or give us a call at 646-580-0360. It can be lonely here in the epicenter of the collapse of civilization, so we love hearing from you. And that does it for this week's show. Thanks very much for listening. We'll be back next week with a new show. But in the meantime, on our website, on Facebook and Twitter, we've got new arts and pop culture stuff every day. Studio 360 is a production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Michael Guerriero,
Sarah Dalia,
Katie Palmer,
Mary Du.
And thanks in perpetuity to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tiegel.
PRI Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees. By the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. And by Scion, presenting the redesigned Scion TC, featuring a 180-horsepower engine and responsive handling, giving you the power to maneuver today's congested cities. Get there at Scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, he writes music about toys, bugs, and international politics.
Now the country that we're living in,
to be the world, USA!
That's right! Never been about keeping you out.
Randy Newman talks about his new album and plays us a few tunes. That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI.
Pretty soon you're gonna take their place.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.